But the main goal is to ensure that applicators, those working with pesticides professionally in states, have access to training information and that they know what the licensing or certification process is. Now, there are 50 different states and there are 50 different ways that that's done. Here in Florida, our office primarily works to put together the training manuals that our applicators will use. And that covers like 27 different categories, everything from seed treatment to aquatic plant management. The test, our office, unlike a lot of states, we actually write many of the exams and then work closely with our Department of Agriculture to make sure all of that is communicated to the professional applicator.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com. Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wyzenetics. I am Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from the campus of Oklahoma State University. Today, excited to have on a pair of guests. We have Dr. Brett Boltemeyer with the University of Florida Pesticide Information Office. He's an assistant extension professor. And Dr. Jason Farrell. He is with the University of Florida Agronomy Department and Director of Pesticide Information Office, along with some other titles. But I'm going to let both of those gentlemen kind of drop in. We'll start with Brett first. I always jump in with this. Brett, tell us a little bit about how you ended up in the position you're at U of F.
It actually started with thinking I was going to be a marine biologist and then quickly realizing everybody wants to be a marine biologist. And that's a real competitive field. Quickly looked for a summer job in the Midwest, actually working with aquatic invasive plants. So out on a boat, managing plants out in the field. That sort of got me involved with pesticides and managing plants, which then took me to the University of Florida for my master's and PhD, where I very much ran into the face we see on the recording with us, Dr. Farrell. He served on both of my committees. And then after graduating, wandered into private industry for a while. I worked for a company that did mosquito control, aquatic control, and started to shift from research into a little more sales, liaison between operations, and really kind of got into this pesticide safety world, trying to help our applicators understand how do you read these labels, how do you do the things you're supposed to do and be compliant. And that ultimately led me back to the university when Dr. Farrell took over at the Pesticide Information Office. And their goal there is to teach pesticide safety, compliance regulations here in the state of Florida. So kind of a roundabout way to go from dolphins to pesticide safety, but here we are.
The funny thing is, Dr. Boltemeyer, if you move into Oklahoma and Kansas, it's not marine biologist, it's a vet. Everybody wants to be a large animal vet. And so we have a whole lot of those in undergrad. We got a few marine biologists, but they focus on catfish. Dr. Farrell, share with us kind of your background and your current position, sir.
So I came from a little farming community in West Kentucky and always knew I wanted to be engaged in some form of production agriculture. So I ended up at the University of Kentucky, found the field of weed science. I said, you know, that is a pretty cool thing to do. It's instant gratification. So I got a couple of degrees at the University of Kentucky, went on down to the University of Georgia, finished up a PhD there, and then took a position in research and extension here at the University of Florida. I've been here almost 20 years now, but I started finding my way into administration. So I'm now essentially out of the research business, but finding a lot of opportunity at both the agronomy department as well as directing the Pesticide Information Office.
So tell us a little bit, and I'll go to Brett right now with this one. You know, tell us a little bit about the Pesticide Information Office. What is that? We don't have anything like that here in Oklahoma, or at least by that title. So share with the group what that is.
So there are people like me in every state. So you do have them there in Oklahoma. They are called something different. I've worked with both of your pesticide safety educators.
That is the name we go by.
But the main goal is to ensure that applicators, those working with pesticides professionally in states, have access to training information and that they know what the licensing or certification process is. Now, there are 50 different states and there are 50 different ways that that's done. Here in Florida, our office primarily works to put together the training manuals that our applicators will use. And that covers like 27 different categories, everything from seed treatment to aquatic plant management. The test, our office, unlike a lot of states, we actually write many of the exams and then work closely with our Department of Agriculture to make sure all of that is communicated to the professional applicators. Now, sort of second from that, we also do general safety outreach to those that may use pesticides but aren't in that professional realm. So things like blogs and just general information. Now, when I say our office, it's not just me. We work through the extension network here in the state. Each of our counties has extension agents that will, again, double up with safety training. And here, until recently, did most of the testing. So our county offices hosted the pesticide testing that people would need to get that professional certification.
So Jason, I'm curious, trying to get an idea of the difference in states, because every state's a little bit different. Here in Oklahoma, we have both commercial and private. I'm a certified commercial applicator. I achieved that earlier, figuring that, you know, in my realm of nutrient management and agronomy, that was a valuable thing to have. Do you have similar as a private? Because lately, certifying the private applicators have been kind of an interesting change in our state as the requirements on the private side has changed. Is there a similar license in Florida?
Yeah, there is. And EPA has recently gone through and really changed their certification and training standards. So that's what has caused this big ripple effect throughout all these states. So private has historically been this big catch-all category that allowed people to do all sorts of things since you're operating on private land and you're not out there selling service. But private had a big change with this last C&T update, as well as all of the other changes and updates that the EPA is going through. So we're finding ourselves in a really interesting time in a compliance standpoint with where EPA currently is versus where they have historically been.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting as that hits. I've had to have a discussion with my department head more than a couple times as that new that new standard on the private hit and the need for private applicator CEUs hit, nutrient management talks were much less and lower demand. And so my county level extension meetings went down in the tubes for the first couple of years of that hit. And I've actually developed extension programs focused on private applicator licenses fit within the realm of nutrient management with fungicides. I also do precision tech, so that brings in the drone application. So I've had to completely revamp my county level extension programming to be of relevance now that the private CEUs was such a demand those first 2 years or so.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like I said, that's just one of the many changes we're seeing. EPA is in a position where we're seeing changes now that is as big as the change that happened when EPA was first formed. So, you know, if you look back, Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, all of that culminated in the creation of the EPA and licensed applicators, in the fact that the label is the law and record keeping, all of these things that nobody had ever heard of. That all started in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. We're in a position now where we're getting ready to see that same level of change moving forward in the very near future. And we need people to appreciate that, understand what they need to do to be compliant, because the landscape is very different than it was just a few years ago.
Well, we're having a fascinating discussion. I'll let Brett follow up on this. At Oklahoma, is that, you know, our county educators weren't told to have to be certified, but they're referring to fact sheets. Now, just for liability, we're going to ensure that that's going to be now in the hiring documents, that they have to be certified at least at the private level, if not commercial level, even though we tell them don't give the recommendations, but provide the fact sheets and recommend labels. But just on the liability side from the university, the discussion is they have to now be certified.
Well, it's been interesting watching to Jay's point about the EPA making this dramatic change. You had sort of everything set up when EPA gets started, the idea of now we're registering pesticides for more than just the contents of the jug. It's what is it doing? Where is it going? All the safety pieces. But you kind of had EPA said, okay, we're going to register everything. States, you figure out what that looks like. And so 50 different states came up with 50 very different versions of that. And I think a big piece of this change is the EPA is going, everybody needs to not be identical, but we need to come back a little more to the middle. There needs to be some consistency in what we're doing across the states so that we can regulate that better. And I think to Jay's point, it comes to the big changes that EPA is going with on endangered species and just the sheer level of technical competence that we are going to be asking applicators to have. We need consistency in what we're teaching in those standards so that we can start to get that information out.
So you've basically hit on it, but where does the land grant and the universities partner in, and where do we play a part? Because you have the EPA, you have the commercial. We tend to be stuck, and we have the Department of Ags, because we all got to play well Department of Ag and support them, because at least around here, our Department of Ag doesn't have the capability to be doing all the training or certification. So where does land grants come in, not just providing education, but in what ways can we lead or at least provide pathways?
So I really think where the land grants got started is originally USDA was the one that managed the education part of this because USDA used to oversee FIFRA. It was not EPA. And so it was this natural sort of infrastructure in place. And they went, well, we've been teaching about all these other things through the cooperation with land grants and USDA. Let's add pesticide safety to that. So it was written in requirements years ago that every state had to have a pesticide safety educator, and it was funded through USDA. So early on in the formation, you had this natural infrastructure in place that land grants are where this would happen. And then when you look at going forward, USDA has been out of the picture for this realm for a long time.
Yeah.
But it stayed at land grants because, again, the infrastructure is there and it makes sense. If I'm talking about, pest identification is an important part of pesticide safety or how you use pesticides, it makes sense to be at an institution where the person that is a world expert on those insects is there. Or, hey, if you will do weed treatments early, you'll reduce the amount of pesticides in your risk. Well, I'd better have some weed scientist right at hand. And land grant institutions have that built in. And I think to your bigger point, that's where land grants stand with this big change is we're already connected to the stakeholders very intimately. There's the expertise across the board in place to make sure the information is correct. And then a distribution network that can get it where it needs to go.
And maybe you could speak to this, maybe you can't, and you might let Dr. Farrell address this one. Where does the relationship with EPA and the specialist lie? How much interaction is going on? I felt like there's been some things that have come down pretty abruptly that I go to the what I would deem as experts, and it didn't quite make sense to the leading experts.
Well, I'll say this. EPA has, they have been forced into changing how they do business. And it's because of lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. They have been sued into a new position. So because of that, they are, the old analogy, they're sort of building the plane as they're flying it. They have to comply. Some of these lawsuits and some of these mandates that have come down. So they are having to put things in place, and we are having to, on the back end, kind of say, hey, this makes a lot of sense. What if? But the fact of the matter is, you made a really good point just a moment ago that you've got EPA, you've got the state departments of ag, and then you have the university. And we all have very unique roles to play. And we all need to stay in our own lane because we have expertise. So EPA is forming the large overarching umbrella concept. the state is coming in and tailoring that to the needs of the individual stakeholders of that state while assuming the authority to do all of the regulatory check-ins and compliance. The university, we don't have any responsibility to regulate or to ensure compliance, nor should we. So our strength is education, because in Florida, not all states are as fortunate as us. We still have a county office in every county in the state. So we can touch every stakeholder in a meaningful educational way. So what we're doing is we're all trying to talk back and forth while staying in our lanes and making sure we're following what needs to be done. But to that point, Dr. Boltmeyer's been in conversations recently where EPA was there and they asked some really pointed questions and he provided some good input and they were taking notes. So EPA, they're very interested in getting this right. It's complicated, man. And the stakes are very high because any misstep, they're back in court.
I'll add, we go back to the earlier conversation that the pesticide safety educators were housed in USDA. There was no relationship with EPA. Mm-hmm. And it's been recently, it used to be EPA worked with the states, the departments of ag, and said, you guys go carry this out. Well, then, and naturally, a lot of those states, the departments of ag and the land grant institutions have a very close connection. So it was this informal connection, but it all ran down and then out. Now that PSEPs were sort of orphaned and EPA has had to adopt us, that USDA isn't there, as all of these changes are coming in place, there's been a recognition by EPA. There's a huge voice that's missing. Mm-hmm. And that voice is the educators. And in a lot of way, the educators are directly connected to our stakeholders. So you want to talk about getting, you know, pesticide applicators into the room, having folks that work hand in hand with them very intimately starts to do that. And I think to Jay's point, you're looking at EPA not only going, let's bring you into the room, but then hearing some really good things and going, there's a lot of advantages to having all of us in the room together to solve some things before they become a problem. So I think we'll increasingly see that going forward, especially as it gets more complicated.
And Jay, I'm glad you said what you did. I kind of laid it up hoping you had explained that the EPA was not just blindly walking through, but they were forced, or they had a lot of pressure to make immediate changes. I think that's an important point to be made. I want to say here, I'd like to hear about what's happening in Florida, because here at Oklahoma, we're the same. We still have an office in every county, and we feel quite blessed that we do, because there's so many states that have gone to more of a regional. And I can, it's the additional need for education in a state with an office in every county was significant. I can't imagine those that don't have that. How has that been either at the state level for you, or what you may have seen around in interacting with other states? Because it was a pretty big ask right off the front, because all of a sudden you had a significant number and need nationwide for individuals to be trained. In many places, probably, I'm going to guess, may not have had the resources at hand at that moment.
Yeah. And, you know, having an office in every county is a wonderful blessing, but there's also a bit of a curse that's tied in with it, because the more people you have, the more people you have to educate. And Florida, like a lot of states, we have a significantly reasonable turnover every year in extension. So you roll out this great program, you get people trained, and then a year and a half later, you look in across the room and go, I don't know those four people over there, or who are they? So you're having to constantly train and retrain. So yeah, it has been a big lift to get everybody on the same page. And we're not even anywhere close to having it accomplished yet. Mm-hmm. But you put on that the added complication that EPA is still working through some of these things as well. And they'll add something to their Bulletins Live 2 website. We'll go in there. It's like, oh, man, this is going to be a huge impact on our farmers. And then you go back 6 months later and they've changed it and some of that language is gone. Meanwhile, there's something else that's there. Mm-hmm. So the landscape is shifting so quickly we're trying to just really stick with big picture concepts and get people, get their head around conceptually what is going on. So then they can start digging into it. Cause man, this is a roller coaster and you just got to strap in and get ready for the ride.
And that's a great point. Yeah. I was going to add and breaking that is that I was going to ask because we can't in education be that specific anymore. We used to be able to go to, I felt like we'd be down to the label and say, this is how you use dicamba. This is how you use atrazine. This is how you use any insecticide. And now it's okay. This is the active ingredients. Here's a website you need to watch on a weekly basis to see if it changes. That's at least in fertility. That's how I'm feeling as I'm trying to keep track of my own applications as a certified app or a commercial applicator.
I think you've hit it on the head. It's the big change is that where you get your information has fundamentally shifted. Mm-hmm. Your point, it was the label. The label is the law. Well, now the label is a website and there's good and bad with that. The good is it is flexible to change. Sometimes it will change in a grower or a user's favor. Sometimes it will change to be more sensitive to environmental demands. We can mm-hmm. change things quicker.
Yeah.
The disadvantage is it changes quicker. And the, I know my products, I know what to do and how to do it, especially here for the next handful of years, is going to be all over the place. You know, I'm hoping that they stick the landing and at the end we have, I call it a digital label where it is, I know where to go and what to look for. And this allows us to simplify things and to use language that is simpler, to use pictograms, to do all the wonderful things you can do when you're online, but it's going to be rough getting there.
That's been my biggest challenge. Even as myself, I'm used to going to the jug and looking at that label. Now I got a 2-year-old jug that the product still is within time, but that label's changed twice and teaching people read the right, it's okay, go online and find the latest label. And then some of our applicators may not be savvy to pull a PDF off a line on a regular basis. And then rural connectivity isn't the easiest thing to say, okay, I've now got a jug, I'm middle of nowhere. And even in Florida, you have middles of nowhere.
Yeah.
And okay, maybe we don't have the best access to in-field capabilities.
100%. And the days of sitting on a tailgate on a turn row and going through a label with somebody is quickly leaving us. So it is still highly relevant. It is still a good thing to do as an educator, but those days are going to very soon be in the rearview mirror.
And the concern I know a lot of us have is that is being compliant with regulations becomes more and more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You start having people decide I'm not going to try. And then when they don't try and don't get caught, they just don't comply with anything. You know, think of the road that everybody knows that the cops are going to post up on every few weeks. You follow the speed limit. Here's the road where you've never seen a police officer. Oh, I can go a little faster and then a little faster and then a little faster. And I think the concern is these users go, I can't quite figure this out, but I'm trying, it becomes easier to just not comply. And now you're not complying with environmental things, you're not complying with PPE, you're not complying with rate, and that can cause lots of problems.
So I want to go sideways in our last couple of minutes. It's still in the same vein, but curious on both of your take. What technologies would be critical for one to keep up with the application, but also the liability to prove the application was correct? If we start looking at, you know, ideally, I have a weather station on every sprayer in every field, so I know humidity, wind direction, all the good things. What are some things that our applicators need to be aware of that they need to be looking into technology-wise to know that they're covered both on the knowledge of and post fact?
I mean, I think some of the trends that we've seen in agriculture for many years now, the increasing use of computers and automation. I think that combined with we've started playing around with AI interpreting labels. Mm-hmm. And the more labels get fed into something like an AI language model, the more that perhaps a grower could say, I'm in a watermelon field. I'm using these three products. Put that in and it will say here, here, and here is what you need to do. Your buffer is this. I think to a degree, that's where some of this is going to have to head. And that's a good thing that it will be more precision, more trackable, all of that. But that's a big lift to have all of your equipment connected to a computer, to have the AI models. You're almost becoming the only groups that can survive are those large enough to afford that kind of equipment. And there's clear disadvantages to that potentially as well.
In your environment, Florida, it has so many varied cropping systems, crops, specialty crops, has flagged the field. I don't remember what the true name was, but the flag the field of sensitive crops, was that implemented well? Is it successful? Where is it at?
So are you talking about for the dicamba and the 240 traits? Yeah, so that really didn't impact us as much as it did other states, because where we have those crops is in the northern panhandle, and a lot of our vegetable production is not in that same area.
Okay.
But, you know, to your question about technology, I think we are going to soon find ourselves in a situation that farmers are going to have to almost operate like a hospital. Hospitals have these great big systems where all of people's medical records are all in one system. So everybody can check. You go to a different hospital, it's one format, it's fillable form, da 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 da. I think we are very close to finding ourselves in a market where that type of software is going to really do a lot of the heavy lifting. And if you don't have it or you can't afford it, you're going to hire a consultant that can do it for you. So I think that's where we're headed, that we're going to have to really dig into the computer side of this thing, because paper records are just going to really be cumbersome.
Yeah. And I see it, the technology is there. And that's why I see this as a potential in some sensitive areas, is that we have the capability now to put equipment on a sprayer that shuts down the second an inversion or a wind shift. And for instance, we just had a big, you know, we have all these tools, weather tools, and there's been a few recent suits because somebody did something based upon a modeled that was released. And maybe there was a wind shift. There was recently a large fire that an unpredicted wind shift happened during a prescribed fire. And it was significant, and most of the weather models missed it. And so while we have predictive capabilities, we still need the capability of having that the weather is the weather, and it is as trustworthy as it is. Gentlemen, do you have any other comments? We've run up on the end of our time. Is there anything else you'd like to add? I know, Brett and Jason, I don't stick to the script well, and you provided a whole list of things to talk about, but I went sideways. That's kind of how I roll with this one.
Well, I think it was it's good that people are at least hearing that things are changing. So I would encourage people, if you have an active extension presence in your state, if it's been a while since you've been to those winter meetings, you really need to be thinking about getting to those meetings. Your extension pesticide safety folks, they have this information. You need it. Your Department of Ags are going to start requiring it in the very near future if they're not already. So really start planning to get around, do that winter circuit, and because there's a lot of changes that are both coming and on us already.
Brett,
I would add, you get connected with, you know, the extension network, the Department of Ag, your pesticide safety, and then your grower groups and like Farm Bureau. Mm-hmm. I know here in Florida, the Florida Farm Bureau reached out very quickly to say, hey, let's coordinate on this so that we're all on the same page. And that's been really good, because it dramatically expands the number of times they're hearing this message in the way in which they're hearing it. You know, Farm Bureau may be able to position that message across to them in a very different way than, you know, somebody from a university might. So I would add Farm Bureau's grower groups. All of those are great, because they're really having to stay up on top of this too.
And on a personal side, one of my recommendations for growers and consultants was figure out how to log on to your state CEU and know how many CEUs you have logged in. All of the systems, most of that I talked to, bogged down because they weren't ready for that kind of tracking. We were still sending in papers and they were logged in by a person. And so, the ability to log in and track and know where you're at and know what the state has recorded for your CEUs, your continuing education units, is an important factor.
It's time for our famous three.
Gentlemen, in the last minute or two of the podcast, what's your go-to work resource when you're in your daily life? Where do you go for information?
Google. And I would say another very helpful resource for listeners with knowing all of these changes would be to go to EPA's website, mm-hmm. their Office of Pesticide Programs, and then sign up to get the emails. Because with the updates that are coming, even I don't know some of the things that are coming down the line, to the point where we didn't even get into the ban of the pesticide last week that they haven't done in 40 years. A stop use on a pesticide. Luckily, I got it in my email. So go to EPA, go to the Office of Pesticide Programs and sign up to get those emails, because they have webinars, they have the Federal Register stuff. That will keep you up to date on what's coming. I can't promise you're going to understand it. I'm not going to promise it's not going to be a 600-page document sometimes, but at least you go, yeah. Oh, I've heard of this thing called insecticide strategy. Maybe I should ask so-and-so about that.
And I would encourage people that get connected and stay connected with the extension service in your state. Every one of them have excellent specialists at the state level that have blogs, that have Twitter feeds. If you aren't following your primary specialist in their, you know, primary mode of communication, you're missing out. You really should. And that is how information is being shared now. The county meetings are still a great opportunity, but if you're not following your key specialists on X or on whatever platform you need to be. Mm-hmm. So connect with EPA, connect with your state specialists and your county offices, read their blogs, at least look at them, have them come in. That is the first connection. And then you know what. Now, with that information, you can understand what questions you need to ask and what you need to be informed on.
I'll say my biggest people that I follow on X, or I find the most value, is a pathologist, entomologist, and the weed scientist, just keeping track of them. More so on the pathology side, the entomologist, pathologist, but the weed scientist too, just keeping track of the herbicides. But it's extremely valuable. Last thing, so where do folks go if they want to learn more about or find more information about the University of Florida Pesticide Information Office?
So we have our website, and it is Pest Ed, so like a pest, and then education, ed.ifas.ufl.edu. And then I also have, our office has a blog that we put a blog out twice a month. And we get kind of squirrely in that. We'll have music playlists related to pesticides. We'll have a lot of fun, but then also keep up with the current topics. And that is blogs.ifas.ufl.edu. And then you can search for pesticide information and you'll see all of our blogs. You can subscribe. Comes right to your mailbox.
Fantastic. Well, all that wraps up another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Thanks for joining us today with our guests, Dr. Jason Farrell and Dr. Brett Boltenmeyer with the University of Florida Pesticide Information Office. If you enjoyed this, make sure you hit that like button, subscribe so you know that when we have a new release. Also, share the video with your friends. This has some important information in this podcast today, and I would recommend sharing it with everybody who farms, ranches, or has a garden, because this is really, really important information. Also, leave us any comments and suggest any new guests or questions you may have. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you for having us.
I enjoyed it.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.